Mueller says it's up to Congress. Trump says, I dare you. And Pelosi says, not yet. It's an unimpeachable edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. So what is it about Nancy Pelosi that gets under President Trump's skin so much?
Crazy Nancy. I tell you what, I've been watching her, and I have been watching her for a long period of time. She's not the same person. She's lost it. She's got a lot of problems.
Plus, we look back at the history of relationships between other presidents and House speakers.
Boehner was a speaker who liked to make deals. And I think one of the things that hurt him within his party was he was perceived as working too closely with President Obama. And that meant that conservatives wouldn't get everything that they had hoped for.
And we speak to a former Republican member of Congress about his call for impeachment and what's going on in his party today.
They are enablers. They're excusers. It's unbelievable that they would throw the country out and accept this guy. But we have polarization now where you put party over country. And that's why I really think that our democracy is at risk.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 279 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Negative campaigning is not new in politics. It's as old as the Republic itself. But sometimes an attack on a political rival is not what it seems. Think back to 1970 and Vice President Spiro Agnew's attacks on New York Republican Senator Charlie Goodell, whom he called a radical liberal. His goal was not to take down Goodell, who was running a distant third at the time. It was to create more sympathy for him from the left and take votes away from the Democratic nominee, Dick Ottinger, also a liberal. By doing so, according to the Agnew playbook, the strategy of splitting the liberal vote would help the candidacy of the third candidate, Jim Buckley, the nominee of the Conservative Party. And that's exactly what happened. A more recent example came in Missouri in 2012. Senator Claire McCaskill, a Democrat, was in big trouble in her re-election bid. Several Republicans running against her were likely to win in November. So what did she do? She went after the presumed weakest Republican running, Todd Akin, blasting his conservative record.
Meet Todd Akin. He wants to be our senator. On the mainstream priorities that matter to Missouri, how does Akin measure up? See for yourself. When asked about a plan that ends traditional Medicare, forcing seniors to pay an extra $6,000 per year.
So this is a good idea. I voted for it.
The minimum wage? Akin wants to abolish it.
I don't think the government should be setting the prices or wages on different things.
Making college affordable. Akin compared the federal student loans program to stage 3 cancer.
America has got the equivalent of the stage 3 cancer of socialism.
So that's Todd Akin. End Medicare, abolish the minimum wage, and get rid of federal student loans. Are those mainstream Missouri values? Because they're Todd Akin's.
That sent a subliminal message to Republicans that Akin must be the most conservative candidate in the race if McCaskill was attacking him. So Akin wound up winning the primary and proved to be a disaster in the fall campaign. So what to make of President Trump's near obsession with Joe Biden? Does he really fear him, or is it all a game? Here was Trump during a recent visit to Japan, where he appeared at a press conference with Prime Minister Abe.
And does it give you pause at all to be appearing to side with a brutal dictator instead of with a fellow American, the former Vice President Joe Biden?
Well, Kim Jong-un made a statement that Joe Biden is a low IQ individual. He probably is, based on his record. I think I agree with him on that.
It didn't stop there.
In terms of criticism that you're sort of supporting a dictator instead of an American vice president?
Well, when I look at what's been done by our vice president and the president, when I look at the horrible Iran deal that they made, look what happened since I terminated the Iran deal. Look what has happened to Iran. Iran, when I first came into office, was a terror. If you look at the deal that Biden and President Obama signed, they would have access, free access to nuclear weapons where they wouldn't even be in violation in just a very short period of time. What kind of a deal is that? So we can't have that. Plus, there were many other things they did that were very bad. So I don't take sides as to who I'm in favor, who I'm not. But I can tell you that Joe Biden was a disaster. His administration with President Obama, they were basically a disaster when it came to so many things, whether it was economy, whether it was military defense, no matter what it was, they had a lot of problems. So I'm not a fan.
Now, is this a deja vu of what Spiro Agnew and Claire McCaskill tried to do? Prop up the weakest opponent? Or does Trump really fear Biden, who at the present has a sizable lead in the polls? While we try to answer that, we should also try to answer this week's trivia question. Biden would be 77 years old on Election Day 2020. Trump would be 74. A combined total of 151 years. What was the largest combined age of the two major party presidential nominees in history? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Old man, look at my life. I'm a lot like you were. Old man, look at my life. I'm a lot like you were.
The feud, and that's an understatement, between President Trump and Speaker Pelosi is getting more personal and vitriolic by the day. The latest episode began last week when Trump walked into the White House for an ostensible meeting on infrastructure with Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, but stayed only for 3 minutes. He blasted Pelosi for the bad things she said about him following a meeting with her fellow Democrats, and then went out into the Rose Garden to vent to the reporters who were waiting for him.
So I came here to do a meeting on infrastructure with Democrats, not really thinking they wanted to do infrastructure or anything else other than investigate. And I just saw that Nancy Pelosi, just before our meeting, made a statement that we believe that the President of the United States is engaged in a cover-up. Well, it turns out I'm the most, and I think most of you would agree to this, I'm the most transparent president probably in the history of this country.
No cover-up? The money to silence Stormy Daniels, his grades in college, his tax returns? But I digress.
We have given, on a witch hunt, on a hoax, the whole thing with Russia was a hoax as it relates to the Trump administration and myself. It was a total horrible thing that happened to our country.
He went on to talk about how great he was doing as president, but as always, he came back to the Mueller investigation and the investigators.
And of the 19 people that were heading up this investigation, or whatever you want to call it, with Bob Mueller, they were contributors to the Democrat Party, most of them, and to Hillary Clinton. They hated President Trump. They hated him with a passion. They went to her big party after the election that turned out to be a wake, not a party, it was a wake. And they were very angry. These are the people that after 2 years and $40 million or $35 million, it'll end up being a lot more than that by the time all the bills are paid. This is what happened. No collusion, no obstruction, no nothing. And then I have Nancy Pelosi go out and say that the President of the United States engaged in a cover-up. Now, we've had a House investigation. We have Senate investigations. We have investigations like nobody's ever had before, and there's nothing, we did nothing wrong. They would have loved to have said we colluded. They would have loved it. These people were out to get us. The Republican Party and President Trump. They were out to get us. This was a one-sided, horrible thing.
The bottom line, no cooperation with the Democrats as long as the investigations continue. For her part, Pelosi continued to taunt the president, which she delights in doing.
I pray for the president of the United States. I wish that his family or his administration or his staff would have an intervention for the good of the country. This is not behavior that is rises to the dignity of the office of president of the United States. But having said that, as I said, I actually ardently pray for the president.
Trump would never let any attack go unanswered, so to no surprise, he answered.
You know, she's a mess. Look, let's face it. She doesn't understand it. And they sort of feel she's disintegrating before their eyes. She does not understand it. Crazy Nancy. I tell you what, I've been watching her, and I have been watching her for a long period of time. She's not the same person. She's lost it. And I think she's got a lot of problems. And it was sad when I watched Nancy all moving, the movement and the hands and the craziness. And I watched it. That's, by the way, a person that's got some problems.
And with members of his administration there to back him up, he dismissed Pelosi's claim that he was ranting and angry at their brief White House meeting.
I'm an extremely stable genius.
As the two leaders battle, the speaker is undergoing another struggle, this one with her fellow Democrats, about impeachment. And for that, we bring in Janet Hook, the national political reporter with the Los Angeles Times, who's also a stable genius. Janet, it's great having you back on the program.
Thank you, Ken. Always great to talk to you.
And how do you like that character reference? It's not often that I give that on the show.
No, I'll put it on my wall.
Or on your resume. Before we get to the position Pelosi finds herself in, and I'm fascinated by that conversation, what's your takeaway from Robert Mueller's remarks on Wednesday?
Well, it was really Robert Mueller stepping forward and saying, my work is done, over to you, Congress. He basically said that my report is out. He kind of summarized his summary, didn't add any new information, indicated that he really did not want to testify to Congress, or that if he did, he would say nothing more than what he says in his report. He said, my report is my testimony. So to the extent that Democrats have been creeping forward toward the possibility of having to open impeachment proceedings, they keep thinking, well, let's try one other thing. Let's try subpoenaing documents and people and Trump stonewalls. And then they say, well, we really have to hear from Robert Mueller. And he basically just said not. Or if they subpoena him and get him before them, that he won't offer any more information. So really what he said to Congress was, you've got everything you're going to get from me. You decide. Now it's time for Congress to decide whether to proceed with impeachment.
And I think that's big news, and I agree with you completely because, I mean, the White House and Trump himself said that Mueller's comments changed nothing, that, you know, innocent until proven guilty, and the president was not proven guilty. Now, that's true, but the Democrats are suggesting that, if anything, Mueller's remarks have sped up the demands for Congress to take some action.
Right. I mean, the key thing that he said, and this was repeating from what was in the report itself, he said, if we had confidence that the president did not commit a crime when it comes to obstruction, we would have said so. It was sort of dramatic to hear those words coming out of his mouth. So the question is, what else did Democrats want to hear from him? Well, the other point that he drilled down on was the fact that one of the reasons why he didn't resolve the question of whether or not the president had committed the crime of obstruction was that he was operating under a Justice Department policy that a sitting president could not be indicted or charged with a crime.
Which he said over and over.
He said over and over again. So what I think, if Democrats could have gotten him to testify and go beyond what he said, they would really like to know whether, if not for that policy, would he have considered the president, would he have recommended charges against the president? So there is this unanswered question about what Mueller thinks that they probably won't get an answer to. So Democrats just have to decide for themselves what they think.
Well, that puts Nancy Pelosi in that difficult position because, first of all, there's something about her that seems to goad Trump, that provokes him like no one else can. But at the same time, she's trying to tamper down a growing cry from the Democratic rank and file about impeachment. It's a tough balancing act.
Yes, there really is so much going on between Pelosi and Trump and Pelosi and her caucus. The feud that you described last week between Trump and Pelosi was not just a kind of a quarrel between two people, because Trump quarrels with people all the time. These are the two most powerful people in the American government right now. And until that explosion, actually, they hadn't been getting that nasty and personal with each other. Trump had been treating Nancy Pelosi with a certain amount of deference and respect, didn't have an ugly nickname for her. Pelosi didn't do much to disguise her lack of respect for Trump and the way he's doing his job, but it never got that personal until they had this breakdown over the supposed infrastructure meeting.
All she did was mention cover-up, and then he seemed to go berserk, but Democrats have been saying...
Flew off the handle, yeah.
Right, but Democrats have been saying cover-up for months now.
Well, but she hadn't been saying it, or I don't know, maybe she had. I haven't fly-specked every word that came out of her mouth. There was also this thing going on that the fact that she came out and basically said things about cover-up and almost laying the predicate for proceeding with impeachment, even though she was not recommending that the party go ahead with impeachment proceedings. I mean, there was a way in which she was speaking both to her caucus to say, I'm going to be tough and confrontational with Trump, even if I stop short of agreeing to impeachment proceedings. All the while, that kind of provoked Trump into, you know, higher heights of hostility and quarrelsomeness.
Well, see, here's how I see it. See, I don't think that she thinks Trump hasn't committed impeachable offenses. I think it's more that she doesn't think the country is ready for what would tear apart the country. And so she's waiting to see what the courts will do regarding tax returns or banking records on the assumption that there will be a there, and then public opinion would change.
Yes, I totally agree with you that she's mostly calculating that she can't really get anywhere with impeachment in the Senate unless public opinion changes dramatically. Actually, Nancy Pelosi had a couple of court rulings that came down that bolstered her position that more information was coming that would help bolster the case against Trump. In one case, a court ruled that Congress could have access to the records of his the bank that his business had been dealing with, and in another case, access to the records of his accountant. And so that meant that while the congressional committees had been feeling very frustrated by the lack of information and witnesses coming from the administration, the courts were helping them out. I do think that, though, to the extent that that helped Pelosi put the clamor for impeachment at bay, I think Mueller's statement may have kind of revved up the debate within the party just because it became obvious that they weren't going to get anything more from Mueller.
Yeah, I agree with you. I kind of think that if there were 40 Democrats calling for impeachment now, listening to what Mueller had to say on Wednesday, that number could double in a week or two, and therefore it puts Pelosi in a bind in which she may not be able to hold up the fort.
Right, and to add to the pressure, there were a few more of the 2020 presidential candidates who came out and said, people like Cory Booker, who previously had been kind of stopping short of calling for impeachment proceedings, stepping over that line and saying, okay, Mueller's statement has pushed me to the point where I think now that impeachment proceedings are called for. On the other hand, a spokesman for Joe Biden, who is, after all, the apparent frontrunner in the field, expressly said, I agree with Nancy Pelosi that maybe we shouldn't yet proceed on this divisive impeachment idea. On the other hand, it may be, he said, this is the spokesman for Biden, it may be inevitable that we'll have to get to that if Trump isn't more forthcoming.
Yeah, and you also have people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez who want to hold impeachment hearings yesterday.
Right. I mean, the thing about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is she's been saying it all along. What I'm looking for is who is kind of turning the corner. Like, the measure of the pressure for impeachment building comes from the people who, until now, haven't been calling for it, who now look at what Mueller said and say, oh, man, we really got to go for it.
And more Democrats seem to be saying, let's not concern ourselves what the Senate might do or might not do. we have a duty to do what's right in the House.
Right, or that the political cost of, I mean, to the extent that they're being held back by political considerations, it may be that the political cost of not acting starts to mount, that more and more people think, okay, so if he is guilty of obstruction of justice, why is Congress not acting? And then that puts the burden on the Republicans to say, if they got articles of impeachment sent over to them, why they would not accept obstruction of justice as a grounds for impeachment.
Some people are saying, I mean, I love quoting anonymous people. Some people are saying that Trump is almost hoping the Democrats launch an impeachment inquiry so then when he's exonerated by the Senate, he can go around the country claiming victory. One, I wonder if you think that's far-fetched, or do you believe you think it's believable? And two, do you think any president, and Peter Alexander of NBC News asked him this the other day, but do you think any president wants to be impeached?
Right. You know, the last thing I'm going to do is speculate about what's going on in Donald Trump's mind. I'm too humble to do that.
And you are. Remember, you are a stable genius.
I am a stable genius, yes. I do think that if the House voted to impeach Trump, and then the Senate got the last word, it might clear the air. But I cannot believe that it wouldn't do damage along the way, let alone kind of totally distract from any possibility of getting anything done. I mean, it's already the case that Trump has said, until you stop these investigations, I'm not going to work with you on an infrastructure bill or anything else. So that it's kind of like the whole tenor of the end of this first term of his presidency is being set by impeachment. You know, he probably revels in the fact that this is right now a process that divides the Democrats. He probably likes that. I don't think that his own party relishes the idea of going through an impeachment and then a trial in the Senate. So even if you could say that for Trump, this is sort of a good outcome, this is not a good outcome for his party.
Or the country, and plus the fact that unlike Nixon and Clinton, in addition to everything else, you have a presidential campaign coming up.
That's right. You're right in pointing out that both of those other impeachments happened around the midterm of a presidency.
Second term.
Yeah, second term. And this is really a perilous time, and perilous for both parties in that I think if the fear among Democrats is that they will overreach or they will push it beyond the tolerance of the swing voters that are in the districts, I mean, the risk for them is that regardless of the outcome of the presidential election, that they lose control of the House. I mean, presumably if they won the presidential election, they would also keep control of the House. But a lot of the reservations about proceeding with impeachment come from the members in swing districts that made all the difference between being in the minority and after 2018 being in the majority.
And Trump wouldn't be in the position he's in now had the Democrats not taken over the House in 2018.
Correct. Correct. This is kind of what the party is there for, is what they promised was to provide a check and balance with the Republicans' hold on power and Trump's administration of the government.
So I think basically what we're left with a restless Democratic Party and a Speaker of the House who's trying to hold on to control of the House, but realizes that maybe there may be an onslaught that she can't hold back.
Right. One thing that's clear is, however this impeachment debate, both within the Democratic Party and between Democrats and Republicans, however it plays out, it's just all going to totally dominate the next year and a half leading up to the 2020 elections. So as much as candidates, presidential and congressional candidates, don't really want to talk about this, make this the focus of the 2020 campaign, inevitably it's just going to be hanging over everything.
Janet Hook is a national political reporter with the Los Angeles Times. Janet, thanks for being on the program once again, and I know this thing is far from over.
Thank you so much. It's always good to talk to you again.
Hit me with your rhythm stick. Hit me. Hit me. Je t'adore. Ich liebe dich. Hit me. Hit me. Hit me. Hit me with your rhythm stick. Hit me slowly. Hit me quick. Hit me.
The relationship between Trump and Pelosi, if one can call it that, is probably as toxic as there has ever been between a president and a Speaker of the House. That's not to say, of course, that presidents and speakers have always seen eye to eye. There have been some real battles over the years, and no one is better equipped to talk about it than Matthew Green. He's a politics professor at Catholic University in Washington and the author of the book, The Speaker of the House, The Study of Leadership. Matt, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, we've long known about the battles and conflicts between a president and a speaker, especially when they're from different parties. But can you ever recall a relationship like this one?
yes and no. It's not unusual, as you said, for speakers and presidents of opposite parties to have conflicts with each other. This one is a little unusual in that you've got a couple of things going on. One is this discussion about impeachment, which presidents often take personally, and that's a big issue that is sort of coloring this relationship between Speaker Pelosi and Donald Trump. And then the other is social media, where you can have political figures sort of attacking each other or criticizing each other in real time. And that can at least create the appearance of exacerbated conflict between speakers and presidents.
Well, you know, when you talk about the roles that presidents are supposed to have, I think everyone seems to know what role a president plays, even if Trump is making up the rules as he goes along. But what kind of a balancing act does the Speaker of the House have, especially as he or she has to consider the wishes of the members of the House as well as deal with the president?
So speakers have a complicated balancing act of different interests, and more than I think people realize. So most people think of a speaker as carrying out the interests of his or her party, because it's the majority party in the House that chooses them. And that certainly is important to speakers. But there's other things that they are concerned about as well. They're elected members from congressional districts, so they think about their own district needs, which may not be the same as what their party wants, for example. And they also care about policy. They tend to be interested in policy. That's why they got into Congress in the first place. And then they also think about the president. And they think about the president both as a party figure, so wanting to help the president of the same party or the presidential party if they're trying to get someone elected to the White House. But they also traditionally think about the role of the presidency and the importance of the executive branch, what powers it has, what duties it has. And so from time to time, speakers have felt compelled to actually help presidents of the opposite party because it's one of the roles that they play as a top constitutional officer.
Is there an example you could think of? Because for the most part, I can't recall. I mean, maybe Sam Rayburn, who is perhaps the most powerful speaker in modern times. I don't know if that's considered modern times, the 1940s and 1950s. But it just seems like when his relationship with Eisenhower, for example, throughout most of Eisenhower's presidency, it was almost a friendly relationship trying to accomplish the most good.
Yes, so that is a classic example, is Rayburn. And that relationship that he had with Eisenhower did translate into some important moves that Rayburn made to help Eisenhower, particularly in foreign policy and defense. So there was a major trade bill in 1955, the Reciprocal Trade Act, that a number of Democrats were concerned about, and Rayburn said, we have to pass this. This is the right thing to do. It's what the president wants. There was also conflict with China and a resolution dealing with the island of Formosa, which some Democrats thought, well, why are we helping Eisenhower on this foreign policy stuff? He's being too belligerent, and Rayburn basically shut them down and said, we have to support the president. That's what we do. So we see examples like that under Rayburn, and also his successors, Speaker McCormick, John McCormick, and Speaker Carl Albert, again, on foreign policy, and in particular on Vietnam, where even as their own party was moving away from supporting the Vietnam War, McCormick and Albert would repeatedly support not just President Johnson, but President Nixon and his waging of the Vietnam War and push back against liberals who wanted to cut funding and pull troops out of Vietnam. So it wasn't just Rayburn who did that kind of thing.
What kind of role did Albert, you mentioned Carl Albert, what kind of a role did he play during the Nixon impeachment? Because I don't remember him leading the House the way, for example, Newt Gingrich did during the Clinton impeachment, or how Nancy Pelosi would should there be a Trump impeachment. I don't remember Carl Albert sending kind of signals that this is the way the House should decide on impeachment?
So Albert was more low-key, especially generally as a speaker, but especially with respect to impeachment than, say, Nancy Pelosi has been. But there's actually an interesting parallel there in that Pelosi has been pushing back against some folks in her party who said, we've got to get rid of Trump, we've got to impeach him. And she's saying, whoa, slow down. Albert also was not a huge fan of impeachment, per se. And in fact, there was a famous meeting that took place in his office where some Democrats said, look, we can impeach the president. You know, Spiro Agnew, the vice president, is on his way out. And you'll get to be next in line. You could be president if we get rid of Nixon. And Albert got furious and said, well, we're not doing that. That is absolutely inappropriate. Impeachment is not a power play. It's an extremely serious constitutional move by Congress. And so I think he also, like Pelosi, was cautious about using impeachment, even though Nixon was of the opposite party of Albert.
One difference, of course, between the situation today and the situation back in the early 70s is that Nixon, when he was reelected, won 49 states. So unlike Trump, whose numbers have never been out of the low 40s, once upon a time, this sounds kind of strange to remember it this way, but Nixon was a popular figure in the White House.
That's a good point, yes. And that second term aspect of when impeachment happened was important, as well as Nixon's huge victory in 1972.
I keep reading that Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill used to fight during the day and they would share drinks at night. Were they really that close? Were they really pals after hours, or is that just feel-good myth?
Well, Chris Matthews, who worked for O'Neill, has written a book about O'Neill and Reagan, and has made that argument that they got along well and they were friends, and the conflicts were have been overstated. Now, he would know better than I would because he worked for O'Neill, but my reading of history of the relationship between O'Neill and Reagan was that it wasn't quite as positive and friendly as some might think. They certainly could talk to each other. You know, they didn't fight it out in the press all the time, but there was a lot of disagreements between them, and O'Neill and Reagan just had fundamentally different philosophical views that often came out in their discussions over real policy like taxes and budget.
That's how I remember it too. I mean, basically Reagan went over O'Neill's head by trying to get all those Democrats to sign on to his tax cut. And I know O'Neill didn't like that, but I kind of remember them back then as being more opposed to each other and more at odds with each other than some guys who could just disappear at night and drink together. That just doesn't sound right to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. Again, I don't know what they did in their private time. I mean, they did drink together, but the fights continued through all of O'Neill's time as Speaker, and not just on the budget, but also on funding for the Iran-Contras. They just fundamentally disagreed, and O'Neill and Reagan were fighting all the time over whether to pass funding bills for the Contras. And sometimes, O'Neill would win, and Reagan was very upset by that, and sometimes Reagan would win, and O'Neill was upset. So I think you're right that it's easy to overstate in retrospect how well they got along. There was a lot of disagreement between the two.
And speaking of disagreements, I think of Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton. Basically, Newt Gingrich came to power in 1994 because of his disagreements and his opposition to Clinton policies like guns and taxes. And Gingrich really came out on top of that debate, at least in the first Clinton term.
Right, and especially in the first 2 years. So when Gingrich is not yet Speaker and he is pushing back very successfully, blocking some major Clinton legislation and definitely either, if not helping reduce Clinton's popularity, sort of righting the unpopularity of Clinton. After that, you have this situation for a time where it looks like Gingrich is the center of government. The House is passing elements from the Contract with America, and Clinton is saying, I'm still relevant. And then it looks like this conflict is a significant one, and Clinton and Gingrich is coming out on top. And then you even have two government shutdowns over fights between Gingrich and House Republicans and the Clinton White House. So in 1996, you have the passage of welfare reform, which is passed by the Republican House under Gingrich and signed into law by Clinton. So despite their conflicts, they did find a way to come together for some major legislative accomplishment.
And then came impeachment.
Of course, Gingrich was in an odd situation there. He was not necessarily leading the fight on impeachment, perhaps because of his own personal background. But he ends up having to resign from the House in the midst of this impeachment debate. So, you know, Clinton ends up surviving that. But it's again, you're right, to bring it up again to impeachment, it seems to be a theme here in history of this extreme conflicts that can turn into attempts to remove a president.
I think we mentioned earlier that for the most part, presidents and speakers of the same party usually fare pretty well. Like, and I'm thinking of like George W. Bush and Dennis Hastert, and then later with Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi.
Correct. You know, there's always a potential for conflict, even with same-party presidents and speakers, but perhaps it's a consequence of politics becoming more partisan and the desire to get legislation through when you have unified party government. You do see some fairly significant legislative successes that come out as a result of a cooperation between a president and a same-party speaker. So thinking just, for example, about the passage of Obamacare, where you have this major legislation that's connected with President Obama, and Nancy Pelosi is working overtime to get it enacted in the House of Representatives.
And with Bush and Hastert, you had tax cuts and you had the war on terrorism and things like that.
Yep, and also the expansion of Medicare, where Hastert famously kept the voting clock open to get a couple of extra votes he needed. So that's another example of sort of speakers carrying the president's water.
But you could also make the argument, or maybe the opposite argument, with Gingrich, that Gingrich was as responsible as anyone for ending the presidency of the first President Bush. You know, he led the House revolt against Bush's reversal on Read My Lips.
Right. Now, Gingrich wasn't speaker at the time, but he was the minority whip. And Republicans generally expected party leaders to support a same-party president, even if it was a policy they disagreed with. And Gingrich had been part of these negotiations with the president over budget and taxes. And so you have this famous press conference where Bush comes out and says, here's our budget. It raises taxes. I know I'm breaking my promise, but we have to do it. And Gingrich is nowhere in sight. And he comes out and says, I oppose it, and I'm going to fight it. And it loses. And yes, I think not only at the time, but with historical perspective, it's safe to say that that was a very damaging blow to the presidency of a Republican president.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of people who, to this day, blame Gingrich for Bush's 92 defeat.
Yeah, and there's other factors that go into that, certainly. But, you know, if you go back and read the stories and what people were saying about how it was the worst policy defeat of the Bush presidency, that's just not something you want to have in your record when you're running for reelection.
And, you know, I think when John Boehner became speaker after the 2010 rout, you know, there was a 63-seat pickup. But it seemed like he had as much problems with his own party, like the Tea Party folks, as he did with President Obama.
Yes, and it's interesting to look at those divisions in his party from the perspective of relations between presidents and speakers, because Boehner was in many ways a speaker who liked to make deals, which is not uncommon. He liked to make agreements and get things done. And I think one of the things that hurt him within his party was he was perceived as working too closely with President Obama and trying to make deals that meant that conservatives wouldn't get everything that they had hoped for. And so, the irony there is that it may have undermined his own ability to serve as speaker, that desire to work with an opposite party president to try to solve, to resolve national problems and get a major policy enacted.
Plus the fact that so many Tea Party folks wanted continuing votes to repeal Obamacare, and Boehner knew as well as anybody that you're not going to get rid of Obamacare when the guy in the White House is a guy by the name of Obama.
Exactly. And he was perfectly happy to let the House vote to repeal Obamacare, knowing it would not go anywhere. But if the government was going to be shut down or we might default on our debt because of it, that's another matter.
Who would you describe as the most successful speaker, or at least the speaker whose relationship with the president brought about the most accomplishments?
Hmm. Well, if we start, I would start with Rayburn in terms of the modern speakership. I wouldn't name one person necessarily, but I'd have to say that the top folks would be Sam Rayburn for sure, because of his ability to work with presidents of both parties and his effectiveness as speaker. And Nancy Pelosi for sure, during her 2 years as speaker under Obama, was had significant successes in enacting legislation. And there were other speakers who were also successful, but that probably go up there. Tip O'Neill, perhaps, and Tom Foley, and I think Hastert probably should get more credit than he's given for his leadership under Bush, especially.
I remember when Jim Wright became Speaker, there was a time when people say he was going to be the next Rayburn, but he flamed out pretty early.
Yes, so he's an interesting case because as majority leader before he became speaker, he actually worked with Republicans to some extent. And when he first was sworn in as speaker, a number of them, including Gingrich, said, I think he's going to actually be pretty good to work with, and he's going to be hard for us to complain about. That didn't last long. He proved to be a very partisan speaker and wanted to really keep the Democrats unified to enact legislation without Republicans if need be, in order to at least position the Democrats against President Reagan. And Republicans got very, very resentful of the tactics that he used, and it ended up making him quite vulnerable.
Yeah, it was those mindless cannibals that forced him out of office. Remember that?
Yes, I believe that is what he said. And it was a period, right, where you had some pretty nasty, almost personal conflict going on in Congress. Right after it happened, Bill Alexander, the whip, started filing ethics complaints against Gingrich to get back at him. It wasn't necessarily a very pleasant time.
Yeah, unlike today, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right, some things haven't changed.
Matthew Green is a politics professor at Catholic University in Washington and the author of the book, The Speaker of the House, The Study of Leadership. Matt, it was great having you on the show.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
Master of the House, quick to catch your eye.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last son or daughter of a governor to go on to win election as governor on their own? The answer, Chris Sununu. A Republican from New Hampshire, he's the son of John H. Sununu, who served as governor for 3 terms in the 1980s. And the randomly selected winner is Philip Kirstein of Princeton, New Jersey. Philip wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttle button winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. Our last contest led off with a Kay Hutchinson button from Texas. That was followed by a Sarah, S-E-R-R-A, for Senator button, which was then followed by another Sarah for Senator button. So when you combine Kay and Sarah and Sarah, you kind of get
Kay, Sarah, Sarah, whatever will be, the future's not ours to see. Que será, será, what will be.
Rest in peace, Doris Day. And the randomly selected winner is Randy Truman of Albuquerque, New Mexico. The new puzzle goes up on our website this weekend. You can find that as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Whatever will be, the future's not ours to see. Que será, será, what will be.
We spent a segment last week on the decision by Michigan Congressman Justin Amash to come out in favor of President Trump's impeachment, the first and only Republican member of Congress to do so to date. Of course, we'll see what, if anything, Robert Mueller's farewell address on Wednesday adds to the conversation. It was a 9-minute statement that was careful, exact, professional. It wasn't an indictment of the president, but it was hardly the pro-Trump exoneration we heard from Attorney General Bill Barr. This may have been the most telling comment.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
But as of now, Amash's support for impeachment hasn't started any groundswell within the GOP. If anything, it's gotten Republican voters in his district back home angry, and it's produced a primary challenger for next year. There's another Republican congressman calling for impeachment, only this one has been out of office since 1993. Tom Coleman, first elected in 1976 from a district in northwest Missouri, had an op-ed in the Kansas City Star last week in which he described Trump and Vice President Pence as illegitimate and deserving of impeachment. I remember Tom Coleman from back in the day. He was a moderate Republican who represented a district long held by Democrats. In fact, if memory serves, he was the first Republican to represent the seat since Eisenhower was first elected. In his op-ed, he often referred to the Mueller report that detailed the relationship between Trump and his campaign with Russia for the conclusions he has drawn. So we know why Coleman wrote the column. What I want to know is what is keeping other Republicans still in office from coming to that same conclusion. And so, Tom Coleman, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Well, thank you, Ken. That's quite a question you've asked and put on the table.
Well, I think I agree, and I think we both agree that, look, it's much easier for a Republican who's been out of Congress for more than 26 years to write an op-ed calling for Trump's impeachment than it might be for a Republican who has to face the voters next year.
No doubt about it, but I do want to point out that you're not elected to high public office to be a scaredy cat. And having gone through the process of winning and losing elections, it seems to me that the people who are, and I'm talking most about the Senate here, because the whole impeachment issue may be decided in the Senate chamber. Senators are well-known in their states, one of the most well-known people in their states. And if they cannot survive a primary because they stand up for what's right and what's appropriate and what's constitutional, what's part of our democracy, and they can't win, then they're either ineffective campaigners or there's some other problems. That's why I have been asking for Robert Mueller, who declined today, to actually go out and make a statement to the Judiciary Committee in the House and put a face on his over 400-page report. I remember, as you do, that the Watergate hearings were riveting and that it was like a soap opera. Every day there was a new revelation, and you had to see it, and you had to understand it. And in the end, just like today, all the Republican senators went down to the White House finally and told Nixon he had to go because the evidence was clear. The evidence is clear here, but if you fast forward, you know, 40 years, we have polarization now where you put party over country. And that's wrong. And that's what really bothers me and why I really think that our democracy is at risk.
Well, let me go back to something you just said, which I'm not sure I agree with. You talked about that the Republicans are not stepping up, criticizing the president because, well, they may be ineffective campaigners or you know, lack of profiles and courage. But when you look at people like Mark Sanford, the former congressman from South Carolina, when you look at Jeff Flake and Bob Corker and others, they're no longer in Congress because they either lost their primary because of criticizing Trump or they were forced out because the Republican voters made it clear that they could not win another term. So rather than criticize, I mean, you could criticize Flake and Corker and Sanford all you want, but I think the fact is that when you stand up to the president, he has such control over the Republican Party electorate that it's almost a suicide mission.
Well, I'm going to throw something out here, an analogy, and see how you like that. I remember that the Munchkins in the Land of Oz were so afraid of the wizard until they pulled the curtain open and saw it was just a guy with a microphone. In that same movie, The Wizard of Oz, we had a scarecrow who wanted a brain. We had a tin man who was looking for a heart. And we had a the lion who wanted and needed courage. So if the Republican members of Congress should look at this and not want to be munchkins anymore, they could get the brain and use their own brain and not let Trump think for them. They could go ahead and follow their heart and do what's right. And finally, they could get some courage and backbone and stand up to this wannabe strong man. To me, there's no question about it. And since I know some of these senators personally and served with some of them personally in the House before they went to the Senate, I am so disgusted that they will not stand up. Maybe they will talk privately, but they don't stand up. And so that's why if it's former members like me who speak up, so be it. Amash has spoken up. He's not necessarily the most popular person in his conference anyway, but he's doing the right thing. And I think today's activities about the Mueller report and all that went on, it's just going to light more of a fire to have an impeachment process start.
Well, you referred earlier to the impeachment case against Richard Nixon, and John Rhodes, who was your party's minority leader when you first came to Congress, was one of those leading Republicans, along with Barry Goldwater and Hugh Scott and Bob Griffin and others, who went to Nixon in 1974 and told him it was time to give it up.
That's right. That was the leadership. And where is the leadership now? It's just, it's unbelievable. They are enablers. They're excusers. And again, it boggles the mind to think that this guy who every day, you know, shows that he has very little understanding of the office of the presidency, very little talent for the office, who's mentally and emotionally unfit for the office, and has probably never read the Constitution or knows what's in it. It's unbelievable that they would throw the country out and accept this guy instead. It's just, I don't understand it. And it's a cult of some sort. But I'm going to work hard, and I think there's enough people, because they showed that up in last year's elections for the Congress. It was an overwhelming rebuke of this administration and of this president.
Let me go one more thing about Nixon. I seem to be obsessed with Richard Nixon these days, but you were running for re-election to the Michigan Assembly back in 1974.
Missouri, yeah.
Do you remember Nixon being an issue in your campaign, and do you remember how you felt about him?
Absolutely, Ken. I think of it all the time. In fact, I think about it more today than 10, 20 years ago. I was the first Republican in my county to be elected ever, that's over 150 years, to the state legislature as a Republican in 1972. In 1974, I was running for re-election, and I obviously was aware of what was going on. In August, Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon. And, of course, I'm going door-to-door and campaigning like, well, that can't affect me because, you know, I'm not even in Washington. And, of course, I had nothing to do with Watergate. You know, I was young and naive. I won my reelection by 500 votes. It was about a 52, probably 48 or something like that. It was much closer than it should have been because it was all the way down the ticket. When the people turned on Richard Nixon and the Republican Party, they took it out on everybody, even people who had no association, was on another level of government, and who, frankly, was doing a good job. So, yeah, I think about that because Watergate had a tremendous impact. And we created what we call the Watergate Congress, the Watergate babies in Congress. They held offices, they held speakerships, chairmanships for almost 40 years after that.
I know there's no way to know for sure, but let me throw this question out at you. Do you think if you were still in the House, still hoping to win a Republican primary next year, on the way to another term, do you think you could have done what Justin Amash did?
I would hope that I would. But I will say this, taking my own personal situation, I always wanted to go into public service, so I did that. And I never was in the private sector other than trying to practice a little law while I was actually a public servant, which doesn't really count. And you don't know what you will do when you get out because you are so tied up with the job and so enmeshed with the job and deeply embedded in that job. And it's a full-time job. So that, for example, my own self, I lost my election in 92 I had no job lined up. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I had one daughter finishing college. I had another one going in and one more at home. And, you know, it was really a depressing time for a couple of days. But you pull yourself up and you go on. There is life after Congress. And these people need to recognize that if they're not part of the solution, they're part of the problem. They need to get out of the way.
If there is just only Justin Amash, and I mean, who knows what's going to happen? Even Mitt Romney, who has been somewhat of a critic of the president, has said that he doesn't agree with the conclusions that Amash came to. But if there is an impeachment inquiry and it becomes Democrats for impeachment and Republicans against impeachment, is there a risk that this is seen as just partisan politics as usual?
Well, there is that risk, but I believe that once you have the public understanding, and maybe today was the beginning of it, instead of listening to the president excuse all of his crimes, that people will be educated like the Watergate hearings, and that they will demand that the temperature will be turned up on these people. And I point out there's at least 30 Republican senators that are up for re-election next year. And I think there's 53 Republicans in the Senate now, something like that. And there's 47 Democrats. You need two-thirds to impeach. So you take 47 and you need 20 more to convict. And so how many of those people who are running next year are going to throw themselves when they see, you know, what's happening out in the public domain and the public opinion switching on them? I believe they're going to pull their punches. And I believe that they will be, depending on when the vote is and when the conviction is hearings and is going to be in the Senate. Timing on that would be very important, I think.
You know, that basically mirrors what Elizabeth Holzman, the former New York congressman who was on the show a few months ago, she said that when and she was on the House Judiciary Committee in 1974, she said that when the impeachment hearings began, the overwhelming majority of the American people was still against impeachment. But as more information came out during the hearings, you know, popular opinion changed.
Absolutely. And so the polls may show today that and I think it's about 43-57, something like that, against impeachment. The fact of the matter is we didn't elect the members of Congress to be blindly following polls. They really need to follow the evidence of these hearings and what they produce. And also, if they have a conscience, follow their conscience and know what's right and what's wrong. So I don't put a whole lot of stock in the polls because I know how fast they can change. And I know, having been, you live by the polls, the good ones, and you die by the polls, the bad ones. So my hope is we have the hearings, that they produce enough interest in the public to show that this is not a partisan issue and it shouldn't polarize the country, and that thoughtful Republicans will say, no, this isn't right. This isn't the party that I joined 20 years ago, and out carry the day.
Tom Coleman served 8 terms as a Republican congressman from Northwest Missouri from 1977 through 1992. Last week, he wrote an op-ed in the Kansas City Star under the header, Trump, Pence are illegitimate, impeach them. Tom, it was great having you on The Political Junkie.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it very much, Ken, and maybe we'll do it again sometime.
And I still have your campaign buttons from your races, so next time I'll send you a little picture of it. Tom, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Stand. All the things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
And they know what you're saying makes sense at all. Stand, don't you know that you are free? Well, at least in your mind, if you want to be.